I love it.
Well, welcome back, Adam. Where have you been?
You know what? Don't make it like that. You know I was fired. I was taken off duty for a little while to reflect on my actions of the previous week as well. I've been a naughty boy. Not well, turning up.
Always. It's fine. He's back now.
God.
I know everyone's on the edge of the
disappointment.
Seat.
I know everyone was sending me messages like where are you, where have you been, what are you doing, have you been replaced?
But well,
nah, bitch, I'm still here.
He's back. Well, we're both back. You've been away. We spoke about a bit on the Patreon, so we'll keep that exclusive, very interesting content behind the paywall.
No, I've just been away in London. I've been doing some work placements in the film industry. Ooh, fancy stuff. But no, I was doing some jobs in London and I was away. And we did a little special on the Patreon where I was from a hotel room that I recorded on my phone, so it sounded like I was in a fishbowl. But there you go. We made it work. And now we're here.
Yes.
We wrapped the trip to London quite nicely, to be honest, didn't we?
It was nice. We have a couple of drinky poos and spoke to some interesting people and
oh god I forgot about that. Yeah. what are they doing? Crazy bunch. We got some fans recognized us outside of a bar, basically.
Yeah, that's what happened. That's exactly what happened.
We totally just weren't approached by some drunken ladies who should have known better. And we still don't know what the conversation was about. It was we basically preached at, weren't we?
She just kind of, she did some union thing and she was telling us all about it, but like not in any specific quantity. She was just using a lot of keywords, you know, capitalism.
Just a lot of words,
systems,
really.
Systems, all this stuff. Like, she was saying all this stuff and I'm like, okay, yeah, I think I get the vibe of what it is you do. I don't know what it is exactly.
Or what, how we are involved with that.
Yeah, or why I should care. It was nice just to know that no matter where you go,
there's always the crazies.
Yeah, there's always some crazy bitch hanging about. Brilliant. I mean, the funniest moment was we were with our friend and this lady full verbatim said we live in a society, and our friend goes, yeah, I love the Joker from The Dark Knight, while she's like looking me in the eyes. I'm trying not to laugh.
Had absolutely no idea what we were on about, so I think it was equal on both sides, to be honest. But
no.
That was interesting. Thank you, London, for that.
Yes, thank you, London. Thank you for
having us. Never going back.
Well, I don't know about all that. Mm-hmm. It was actually the nicest, because usually I hate London, and I think it was actually the nicest trip I've had to London in a while, because we didn't do the like
tourist crap.
Yeah, the tourist trap stuff. Like we actually went around a little bit and like around Camden Market and stuff like that, and to pubs and stuff, and that was really cool.
Definitely.
Usually when I think of going to London, I think of like walking down the Thames and being like, oh look, there's Big Ben.
Big buildings.
Oh, look at that. You see that building? It's like, yep.
Yeah.
I went to London. Oh gosh, should I tell this story? Well, it's fine. It's fine. They do. This person does listen.
Yeah.
It was a lovely trip. But I went to London with an ex-girlfriend, and it was like one of the hottest days of the year. We went to the Natural History Museum and oh my fucking God, I hated it.
You were one sweaty boy, weren't you?
It was fucking disgusting, and we got a selfie of us. Like, this guy took a photo of us in the Natural History Museum, and I just
fucking hell.
I look like the Zorbloff. I look like I'm melting. It's fucking disgusting.
Fucking melted ice cream, That's amazing.
Because it's a big stone oven full of people.
Yeah. And then you go underground and you just get cooked further.
Yeah.
Slow like cooked.
Dioramas of penguins. Like, this is great.
It was awful. Yeah.
No, London's always nice. But it is
nice when you do the stuff that you want. You know, if you just go there and you just look at the tourism stuff. I remember I used to just go up on my own just for the shits and giggles when I was old enough. Just to see all the touristy shit that I knew I couldn't drag anyone else to because no one would want to. So I ticked that off the bucket list. And then whenever I've been back, it's been there for a reason. So it's quite nice. And then there's also, you know, all the cool stuff that we explored. So, for example, we went to the Prince Charles Cinema, which is hence the reason for this episode.
Whoa, wait a minute. Did we watch a movie?
See, I was lining that up in my head. I thought that was quite clever.
Well, I think I kind of ruined it. Welcome back to the final draft.
Future's
going now, I guess, anyway. yeah, we're back. We went to... It's me, Alex, and Adam.
Hello.
We went to the Prince Charles Cinema. There's no double feature this week because we're not very organised. But we did watch a movie. Adam, what did we watch?
So we watched Drive, 2011, which is a long time ago now. We're coming up to its 10th year anniversary. They were doing a 35mm print projection in the Prince Charles Cinema, which was lovely. It was a very lovely experience to kind of go somewhere and actually go to the cinema and order a fucking large Coke and some popcorn and... Oh... Gave me chills just going in there and...
Yeah, it was nice to be back and to see... This was my first 35mm, so that was really cool. And what a fitting movie for it. Drive, directed by Nicholas Winding Refn. I think that's how you say it.
Fingers crossed.
Ryan Gosling, Carey Mulligan.
Oh, baby.
Bryan Cranston, Al Brooks, Ron Perlman. Oscar Isaac, great cast, great movie. This is one that you recommended to me back in the day, actually.
I
remember when you were in college, when we were all in college. you and your media studies friends were obsessed with this film, and I think it influenced some of the stuff you guys used to work on.
Yeah, definitely.
and yeah, it was one of those ones.
I made a parody of it for a university project. I made a Uber Eats advert. But it was like it was shot exactly like Drive. It was about a guy who was obsessed with Ryan Gosling and pretended to be the driver from this film whilst he was working as an Uber Eats driver. But it's painted to be exactly like Drive, and the twist is at the end. He's just some takeaway deliverer. But aside from that, yeah, stylistically, it definitely defined... Well, kind of opened our eyes when we were in college studying films. Like, this is a film that is very hyper stylized and is known for it, which is, you know, perspectively why I kind of had some new thoughts on this movie whilst watching it in the cinema for the first time, because I'd never obviously caught it in it. But yeah, very interesting. I'm not quite sure where to start. But
that's a great question.
I guess you just start off by saying, what did you think of it? You know, because obviously I suggested this movie to you a very long time ago, but this is our first time seeing it in a theatre.
It was cool. So when I first watched this movie back in the day, I think this was when I was like doing media studies at college, and I think this was one of those early ones I watched back in the day where I was like starting to think more, dare I say, critically about films, and Drive really stood out to me as being super stylistic but also having really interesting themes and imagery and references. And that was something that really stood out to me on this rewatch, actually, was the very self-aware in like a way that in not an annoying way. It's not like fourth wall breaking, but it's winking and nodding at you, and I like that quality about it, because it is a kind of the story, Ryan Gosling the driver, you know, being this, you know, kind of template protagonist, bit of a blank slate, and going on this kind of what's not maybe not the most compelling crime drama story, is very much like a B movie kind of narrative, and the film's definitely playing with that. And I think it's reflecting on the action genre, and I think Refn really wanted to play with that, those kind of ideas, and he also kind of wanted to tell like a traditional kind of story. He said like his influences were things like fairy tales. He wanted to tell like a modern fairy tale in the vein of like Brothers Grimm, where it's the there's a pure love story at the center of this movie, and then on the outskirts are these violent scenes and kind of intense action, and that juxtaposition and duality, which is a big theme of the film, is duality. Yeah, it's really cool. It's a super cohesive movie, and watching it in a 35mm print, I think really helped contribute to that grindhouse aesthetic. The cinematography is really cool, and it suits film like superbly. I'm sure you've got to comment on the visuals of this film.
Yeah, the guy who shot it, Newton Thomas Segal, is one of my favourite DPs, because how he plays with troubles and things like natural light, you know? And there's a lot of non-natural light in this film, but there's also a lot of scenes just in the open or by windows where the light pours in, and he's always been able to kind of play with that very nicely. And his movie's always very hyper-stylized in that respect and in how they're lit. He also did shoot Bohemian Rhapsody, which similarly did a lot of that kind of stylistic, or had a lot of those stylistic choices with the lighting, which for me is just like, oh,
that makes,
you know,
that makes
I love it. I'm a sucker for it.
Yeah, no, it's got a very cool like 80s infused kind of pastel, but also like very dark neon kind of aesthetics to it. Very much was reminding me of the way Michael Mann shoots LA and things like Heat, and God, what's the other one with Tom Cruise? I watched it the other day. Collateral. kind of like bluey greenish hues, and like very dark cityscapes, very gritty, and it just looks really cool. It's very shiny as well, though. It's got that like glittery kind of aesthetic to everything.
Yeah, it has a polish that's really nice.
Yeah.
And I say, like, you know, he lights very well naturally, but, you know, there is a lot of room in this film where they are able to play with what feels like, you know, it's funny because in his movies, he has a way of bringing a style out of like natural light and natural settings and heightening them to make it more stylized. So in Bohemian Rhapsody, you know, all of the studio stuff and the majority of it wasn't, you know, there wasn't a lot of moments in which used, you know, different kinds of like interior light, but it was like emphasizing the light shining through windows of studios and stuff, and building that contrast. And it's done very well here, but it's also very well considered in all the nighttime stuff. You know, all of the street lamps or the headlights, any light that's in the darkness is kind of accentuated, and used to kind of play into the style very nicely. And like Alex said, you know, seeing it in 35mm print, it did make it feel very kind of grindhousey and grittier, which fits the greater narrative of it too, because to be honest, it's been so long since I've watched it, I forgot how kind of, you know, gritty and dirty this film is, really. You know, it doesn't hold back in many areas. It's very gory, violent, explicit, and does have that weird fairy tale charm to it as well. So it makes sense that the cinematography would reflect that in being kind of hyper stylized. And it's funny, really, because I went into this movie and I know what people say about it. You know, they either really like this movie, they think it's like a cool movie, and they enjoy the ride and it's a lot of fun, or they go with the perspective of, you know, it didn't really balance very well for me, or didn't really, you know, it's because it's very on the nose. It knows exactly what it is. But, and I definitely spotted that more this time, because there's definitely something about seeing a film in a movie where there's absolutely no distraction, and you can't, and the only light in the room is the film that's coming on the, you know, the screen. So you have nothing to focus on and think about other than what's being played in front of you. And I really kind of took in every word and every scene, and it is very on the nose, you know, but I kind of liked it a bit more for that. It was quite charming. It was, you know, there was a lot of dialogue that is very, very movie-esque, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know how to explain it, but you know, you get some pieces of dialogue which are like, they're not realistic, but they're in there for like, to be cool or to, it's like classic, you know, Western movies or film noir.
Yeah, totally.
The nose dialogue.
Yeah, I feel like every aspect of the film is, you know, kind of self-aware to some degree, and is kind of a bit tongue-in-cheek and is a bit knowing, and is being dramatic, from the performances to the writing to, I mean, the music choices in particular.
In particular, definitely.
Yeah, and I usually that kind of turns me off in other stuff. But I think in this, because like I think it works as a movie anyway. Like I think it's a fun ride anyway. Like once this gets going, it really gets going. And I think some of the slower bits and stylistic choices might put some people off, but I think overall it's like a perfectly solid foundation. So when you start to notice self awareness, doesn't really put me off, and actually makes me have more of an appreciation for it, because it's all tied into itself anyway. I think I was like really clocking into it where there's a scene, so Al Brooks is the villain in the piece, and he's a very interesting kind of non-typical kind of villain for this kind of movie, this kind of like him and Ron Perlman, like he's like Jewish mafia kind of mob figures. And they just have like a kind of, they just both individually have like very strange demeanors. And there's a scene where he meets Ryan Gosling, the driver, and they go to shake hands. And Ryan Gosling says, "I've got some dirt on my hands," which is like, because he commits crime. And then he says, "So it's okay, so have I. And it's like, he commits crime. And then they cut to a scene where he's watching cartoons with the kid. And he goes, "How do you know that's the bad guy?" And I'm like, "Very okay." And then he goes, "Aren't there any good sharks?" I'm like, "Very okay, yes. Thank you, movie." But yeah. I like that stuff. I think that's actually very...
it's a movie, you know? Like,
it's clever. And I think like the themes and motifs are so strong in this that like I appreciate that. Like that, it wasn't bonking me over the head. It was like fun and not self-indulgent. And I think that's a really cool thing about his like reference style of directing. I'm not necessarily so crazy about his other movies, but I think this is, I think he's restrained enough in this where it's like, okay, you're having fun, but also you know how to like haul it back.
Pretty drama and suspense, I suppose.
Yeah.
In a way that's not too slapstick and on the nose. Yeah, definitely. I think the music as well is a perfect example of how that adds to it, because it's you know,
it's quite literally telling you how,
yeah,
telling you, you know, how characters are feeling and what they're thinking.
Yeah, literally.
But I like it because like the aesthetic of the music they chose, they went for like electronic and synthy kind of stuff, and it very much suits the vibe of the film. And I don't know, yeah, I mean...
it's just sick. I love it.
If you've seen video assist on YouTuber, a video assist on YouTube, Patrick Willems, who's like kind of one of the granddaddies of film video essays.
Yes, of course.
Called, in one of his videos, he referred to the use of music in Drive. It's non-diegetic character perspective needle drops, and that's, I think, perfect way of describing it. It'd be weird for, you know, the drivers go, wow, I feel like a real human being and a real hero. Instead, you know, the music does it and it works. And also noticed it in the party scene with the "You've got me under your spell," and clearly she's thinking about the driver when her husband's there. And maybe it's a bit too on the nose, but like, because the whole thing is kind of a bit cheesy in a sense, like, yeah, it doesn't really bother me. And I think on a larger scale, the way it's being self-referential, I think it's kind of reflecting on the action genre in a way, because I think so initially in the production history of this, I think Universal picked this up, and it was going to be like a Fast and Furious type spin-off, and they wanted Hugh Jackman to star in it.
Oh fuck me.
And it somehow landed in the lap of Refn, and he said, that's a bad idea, but this book's really cool and I'd like to develop it. So I think because of he kind of saw the direction he was going, I think these ideas were in his head. And, you know, I think it's being very knowing, by the way, that the driver, you know, during day is a stunt driver in Hollywood movies. And he, you know, and you think, and it's like, that's kind of a commentary on movies and genre itself. Like, the real action heroes are the people behind the scenes that you don't see, in the way that the driver is kind of this, hidden person. The opening of the film is a great sequence of his first sort of first getaway we see him do. And I love it introduces, and you see this massive, you know, honking sports car, and then the camera pans over to like a, you know, casual pedestrian car. And they talk about how the car is, you know, under the hood, there's a fat engine underneath there. And that's kind of like a metaphor for the driver himself. You know, he's this, absolute weapon hiding in plain sight. And yeah, stuff like that's really, it's that self-awareness that, sure, when you clock onto it, it's a little, you know, it's a little something, but like, that's what this movie is. And there was a lot of stuff like that in regards to the way they go about action, and I think the hyper-violence of the film as well, because this is something that really stuck out to people when they first saw it, was obviously the insane levels of violence in the film. I mean, Christina Hendricks getting shotgun-headed.
Yeah,
brains splattered everywhere.
I'm thinking more about the scene in the fucking elevator where it cuts to him just watermelon smashing his fucking that guy's head into bits. And it's like, there's a lot of moments in this film that really kind of just shock you, but that is grindhouse, you know, that hyper stylized horror and or just gore. You know, it ties very well into it, because it breaks you away from the mold a little bit at certain parts, and it doesn't overuse it. You know, the majority of this movie is events happening, and it's not very often that it, you know, the climax of them doesn't involve violence. But when it uses it, it's great. So, you know, you have moments like the scene in the elevator where you have this crazy kind of use of lighting in the cinematography and camera movement, where he says goodbye to the woman he falls in love with. It's very romantic. And then literally beats the shit out of that guy and kills him in front of her.
Yeah.
So you have those switches very, very quickly. And
the way he's just completely drenched in blood, and it's the same in the motel scene where with the shotgun, and when he finally dispatches the guy and he's just covered in blood. And it's
the imagery is brilliant.
Refn playing on the fact that there's this kind of pure love story at the center of the film. But I guess it's that juxtaposition and the balance, and the, you know, you've got this purity, and then you've got this pure violence and vitriol too. very sadistic, nasty characters who you meet, and It makes it really fun and it gives it a really interesting vibe. I think audiences at the time weren't necessarily gelling with it. I saw a lot of people complaining about the violence being excessive.
But I'd argue, see that for the time, yeah.
But I'd argue, you know, the intent, we bring them up all the time. I think it's almost a David Lynch approach where, because a big thing of his work is showing the two sides of the spectrum and how you can't have one without the other.
Yeah.
And I find that very interesting, actually, like to weave that into your narrative. The other thing I was going to say about this film is I think the characterizations in this are so strong. Maybe not all across the board, but I mean, you've got Bryan Cranston, Albert Brooks, Ron Perlman, and even Gosling as the driver himself. They're all turning in really great performances and really bringing like a lot of character. And in ways that the film is subtle, one thing I really liked about it was how, even though you have seen, you know, you have like where bits where the music kind of informs the feeling, you're meant to understand how characters are feeling. But I like the strength of some scenes where you're just relying on the actor's performance to give you information. So referencing that scene earlier where the driver meets Al Brooks for the first time, there's another scene where Al Brooks is kind of explaining what happened to Bryan Cranston's character, why he's got a limp because he owed them money, he's in debt to them. And it's very subtle in his performance, but the way Gosling reacts to that information, you get that sense of he doesn't trust him, or he doesn't like him. He takes a distaste to that. And same with another scene was where I really like just the focusing on the performances when Gosling and Oscar Isaac interact for the first time, and there's that sense of awkwardness because obviously we know that. Yeah. He's kind of been forming a relationship with his wife, but I like the way they both navigate that scene, and there's an awkwardness on both ends, and and Oscar Isaac, his facial expressions and stuff, the little kind of like, oh my god, this guy's being and that goes a long way for like adding to the drama and stuff and understanding the characters who are, I mean, in the case of Gosling as the driver, like I said, he's very plasticky and very like not a real boy. But yeah, I like that restraint, and I liked that it was competent enough to do that stuff too. And even you talked about the elevator scene. Something that didn't really occur to me until this watch was like, oh, I don't think that happened. I don't think that was like a real, I don't think he really did that. Which was something that smarter people than me have picked up on. Which I found out in my research preparing for this, but it was something that like had never really occurred to me before. But it was like an extra little detail of like, oh, maybe he fantasized that because the lighting changes and he turns his back on the guy, and why would he do that? And those little things are really, really cool too. And they're not, those are the parts that don't bonk you in the head either. And I guess the ending too, with the way Gosling confronts Al Brooks, and that always rubbed me weird when I watched the film initially, because I always kind of thought like, so he just took him to the car and he got stabbed, but he stabbed him back and it's fine. But when you rewatch it, you see on his face again the subtlety of the performances, you see on his face, and they cut back to their conversation, you can see like the driver is smiling, and he knows what's going to happen, and he's prepared to get him back, and that's like a really nice subtle detail.
A lot of people complain about Ryan Gosling because they, you know, I've heard a lot of people say that he's just the actor of nothing. He just plays the same person in every film. I think that's really, it really rubs me the wrong way, because it seems that with every performance that Ryan does, he may come across as quite stoic, but he puts so much emotion and builds so much character from very little. I feel like he does embody very different characters in all of his work. You know, playing Neil Armstrong in First Man, he really surprised me in the sense that I never knew anything about that person too much in his personal life. But I genuinely did believe that it wasn't Ryan Gosling. even though it feels like such a kind of stoic performance that he would do. I understand that example is a bit vague.
Well, he's good at get that. He's good at being a blank slate, which is actually a lot harder than you think it is, because like you've still got to be charismatic, and it helps that Ryan Gosling is a handsome guy and everything, but the subtleties he brings to his performances and the little inflections and stuff. And he has got range. We stand Ryan on this podcast. I wouldn't agree that he's a limited actor. I think he's got range.
Just some of my favourite movies. You know, he's fantastic.
Yeah.
This is probably did surprise me.
Yeah, this is probably actually one of my favourite Gosling roles, to be honest. Mm. I think, because he works as the driver is, I mean, he's nameless, first of all, and that's very intentional. And Refn talks about how he was very much influenced by kind of the Western genre and samurai movies of the enigmatic action hero who, you know, the stranger from outside who comes to save the day, very stoic. Mm. Ryan Gosling fits the bill as that, and I love his intensity as well. I love the bits where, you know, he's debriefing his clients, and the scene in that bar where he tells the guy, like,
motherfucker. Yeah.
Yeah, he's got a lot of intensity, and but he also does like the warmth, and I guess like the woodenness, like it works because this is a character who is like a fucking robot man. He's like learning to, you know, be a real human being and have feelings.
Yeah, he somehow like comes across as this kind of very stoic person, but you know there's a warmth behind him in his subtle acting where, you know, every now and again he'll smile or smirk or he'll show his kind of lighter side. And I love that. And it means that when you get those moments like where he goes into the changer room and he's threatening to, you know, hammer that bullet into the guy's head, and he's just shaking with adrenaline because you can tell that he's got to kind of put himself in this position of being a threatening individual, but also you just kind of feel for him because it's like you know the sweet soul behind him. And I think that you can pick all of that up from such a subtle performance is brilliant, you know. And like someone like Bryan Cranston as well, he really surprised me in this second watch, because having watched the entirety of Breaking Bad and realised his subtleness also, and how fierce he can be as an actor, he played that kind of very shy, timid, very frightened character very well, which really quite shocked me, to be honest.
I think the Breaking Bad energy he's taking, like, I think Cranston is very good at desperation, and that's a big part of Walter White.
Yeah,
is the scenes where he's kind of pleading and begging, even if it's through his, you know, cocky persona. And I think his character in this is very much a standout, the way he just kind of physically embodies it, and the humor of his character too is very much appreciated, because it's a fun movie too. Like, it, you know, obviously there's this kind of crime drama and romance element to it, but it is also super fun. The action's great. There's generally like funny lines and moments, and I think the weirdness of the character too is appealing. Like, it was interesting watching this with an audience, because it was funny seeing when people would laugh at this, like, like cutting into his little reactions and stuff. Like, Gosling's a weird little, like, when he's just making a weird little face, and being like, okay, yeah, it's okay for it to be kind of funny. And I'm curious as to how intentional that is.
I think it's just an infectious nature of him, you know. There were moments like that in Place Beyond the Pines where, you know, it's weird in that film because he breaks into laughter as he's acting and it feels so genuine because of it. And as an audience, you can't help but kind of smile or laugh at a time in which he's trying to be serious. Don't get me started about Place Beyond the Pines. I love that movie so much. It's so brilliant. And he's fantastic in that film. We'll talk about that some other time.
Yeah, we can talk. Yeah, we'll talk about that another time.
Yeah, I know.
I will say that, and like, I hate to always do this. I feel like this has been a common criticism, but you know, it says more about the genre, the industry, these types of movies than it does about us necessarily. boring female character. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Irene Carey Mulligan.
Classic femme fatale kind of.
She's not femme fatale. She's well, there's a two sides of the spectrum of female representation in this film. She's the Madonna. She's the pure the pure, you know, motherly figure with, you know, absolutely no character. And then you have the whore, which is Christina Hendricks as Blanche, who's like implied to be a prostitute. They very much code her that way. Clearly at the whims of men, is easily pushed around by men. It's like, okay, yep, okay. But I mean, this is also like, whatever. It's. I only bring it up because I think, in terms of things that don't work for me so much. Too. Yeah, well, just in terms of things that don't work so much, the romance element of it. Has never really been my favourite part of the film.
It's a shame, really, because it is the heart of it. And I did feel when I was watching it, I was just pushing for more, you know, because there needs to be that balance. Don't get me wrong, I think, you know, the moments they share together in the film where they'll just be with one another, especially at very early on in the film where they start to establish that they like each other, and you have those scenes where it's just quiet and they might awkwardly like speak at the same time, or they'll just stare at each other. It's genuinely performed really well. It makes you feel that kind of,
yeah, they got a palpable
that
chemistry.
Same sense of looking at someone and not knowing, you're kind of knowing that you feel the same. And I did watch that film and I was like, oh man, you know, that was done extremely well, but unfortunately, yeah, that's as far as it goes for her.
Yeah, in terms of,
you know,
her as a character. Some,
yeah.
When the other side characters are pretty well defined.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, why are you not almost like a secondary character in this movie? Because in essence, you are the core of it. And
we spoke about it last week with Blade Runner, with Rachel, where my issue is like, I understand the role she serves, but what is her character? Like, what's interesting about her, outside of the fact that she's a mother and that, like, I guess she's funny. Like, I guess a very telling scene is like, there's a scene where they're all having dinner together and the dad's telling the story about how they met, and Ted says, you know, sets up this very funny joke, and it's like, okay. Yeah. It's like, it's funny that when any interesting side of the character is spoken about by other characters.
Yeah, literally. It's quite sad, but it's the one reservation I had about Baby Driver.
Baby Driver 2. Yeah.
You know, these two movies kind of fit into that same kind of genre for me. And it always seems that the female characters always take like a backseat, and it's fucking frustrating because there's no reason for it at all. I get that I think in Hollywood it seems to be that it's easier to write a more complex male character who can be both kind of lighthearted and also fierce, or playing to kind of the kind of dominant male figure and writing like the danger behind that. And but that's just all bullshit, you know. There's no reason. There's not an excuse, you know. There's no reason to why you can't write interesting roles for females in these kind of movies. It's weird.
If you're gonna box them in, because I do, you know, the film is about. I think part of the film is masculinity, and I can talk about my take on that.
Sure.
But if you're gonna box them into like a limited role, I can kind of, obviously, I think, maybe nowadays do a bit better, but I can look past it. But just give him an interesting character. I think we said the same thing with Grand Budapest, with Sasha Ronan, you know, like, just, you know, give him more. You're not going to give him more to do, at least give them more character. Like, give them an interesting person to be. Don't just give them these blank slates who are just happy to be there, because it's not very interesting anymore.
It's so blatant as well. It's so obvious when you're watching the film. Because
it's like you put the least interest into that character, didn't you?
Yeah.
Especially when everyone else is so interesting.
It always feels so one-sided.
And it's unfair.
It was pretty blatant.
Yeah, it's unfair on the performers too. But it is a very male-centric film. And I guess in relation to Irene, it's this idea of patriarch and protector, and that's kind of like the role, there's a void that's left in the family unit. And I like the way they play on that thematically in the thing, that, you know, he's a protector for them, and the ultimate way that he can get his desire is her, or to feel, or his intimacy, but that doesn't necessarily line up with his needs, and he has to kind of sacrifice that to protect her, and I like that weaving into the narrative. And I think reference when I spoke about that, he's not like a very masculine guy. He thinks of himself as quite feminine, so he's kind of drawn to these masculine characters and these kind of macho things, and the thing of the cars, and they're very macho, and the action and the brutality, like these are very like macho motifs that he doesn't necessarily align with, but he finds it interesting dramatically. And I guess like the way it's a kind of a reflection of masculinity, the way that the driver is isolated and emotionally cut off, and I think that is an interesting reflection on masculinity, because I think often we are, you know, unless we're watching Paddington, we're not very emotionally out there. But this idea of like father figures being like a recurring thing, like Bryan Cranston is a father figure to him, he is a father figure for the family. The two mobsters are grappling with their families, they're kind of shot off and babied by their families and emasculated, and this all ties into the idea of the hero, and who is the hero, and what does it take to be the savior, and kind of reflecting on that archetype is cool. It's fun, and it's not too, I wouldn't say it's too crazy deep or whatever, but it's an interesting thing to reflect on, and I think they work it well into the film with its thematics.
I never got
that sense of commentary from it. There, it was kind of reflecting on these kind of ideas, and it's a little kind of postmodern, and I guess that comes back to the self-referential nature of it and the self-awareness.
And the, it's a very self-aware movie. And I think that's why I kind of like it, to be honest. I came out of it movie. And I was like, yeah, I just fully accept that it knows exactly what it is. So it's hard to get pretty cross about these things that in a serious drama would be extremely important, or is at least in generally important anyway within film. But it's so well self-contained that it's difficult to kind of pull these aspects that we're talking about out of it, and shame it for it. It feels a little bit more excusable, I suppose.
I mean, it's so tight that I find it hard to really. I like the movie anyway, so I don't have any bones to pick with it particularly. But I think it's so tight and cohesive, and just works fundamentally as this narrative that. I do think there are some missteps, to be fair. Like, we mentioned Real Human Being. Again, it's the romance stuff. I think it's just not really the most compelling stuff. I think they could have done less of that and more action, maybe, to be honest. I don't know, that's kind of silly, because I think the film is kind of reflecting on this need for action in, like, blockbuster action movies. I think it's kind of rejecting that as an idea and saying that you need heart at the center of it. But then I'm also like, oh, it's really cool when he's shooting the guys. So, my little child brain is like, oh, but cargo broom.
Yeah, it definitely tickles that aspect, and it's really hard not to.
But I think that
really
just speaks
enjoy
to,
those aspects.
I think that just speaks to like how solidly those scenes are directed.
They have done really well, yeah.
The car stuff, they spoke about how they've made it, they chose to shoot like very like internally, like internally in the car. Like there's not a lot of, it's only it says, really yeah. in that second, there's only really two car scenes in the thing. There's kind of a third, but it's more just him pushing someone off a cliff. And in that second kind of chase, that's where they get a bit more free with the camera. But definitely the first scene, it's very intimate, and it's mainly just shot within the driver's seats. I really like that because it just adds to the intensity of it all. And the kind of methodical nature of the driver. That's a really cool fucking opening, man. That's a really great.
Yeah, you really start to kind of, you feel like you're sat in the back seat with these criminals because you have as much clue to what he's gonna do as they do, and you know you're watching it, especially on the first watch. You're questioning all of these things he's doing, and it occasionally cuts back to the crooks and they're looking at each other like, what the fuck's going on? And you feel, it makes you feel like you're with them, and it's fantastic because it allows you to really take in his kind of like micro expressions as well. You can tell when something's going well or when he's fucked something up, or he's in trouble.
You need that scene to sell the driver as this calm, composed, complete master of what he does.
Someone who also isn't, should we say, sporadic, or someone who...
No, very methodical.
Methodical, he does, in consideration, which kind of sets you up for the rest of the film as he's not one that's...
Yeah,
poke that easily,
and it sells when things start to spiral out of control. When he starts getting angry, it sells that anger even more.
Exactly. Yes, because
you're understanding that even this is foreign to him. And that's super clever. And even it was just little things like how he's watching the game on the TV, which I didn't notice before. Like he's watching the game on the TV before he leaves. Like that's how precise and like well timed it all was.
And also because he has to be. So when he gets into a situation where it's unexpected, it makes sense that he hasn't got everything sorted out, in his head. But you're excited for that. You want to try and see how he goes about figuring it out. It did sell to all of the times in which he got into a situation that was uncomfortable, that he was scared of. He still kind of was very like that. I think that scene for me that's coming into my mind is when he finds the text on the prostitute's phone in that hotel room, where he's kind of sat there in guilt after having tried to get the questions out of her, because that's a very intense scene, and I felt that in the cinema as well. Like everyone was kind of like, fucking hell, he shouldn't be hitting her. And then he just kind of sits there on the bed just in shame, and then sees the text, and obviously the guys come through the doors with shotguns. He does just a great job of grounding you in the sense of who the character is and how he would react. And makes you feel empathetic as well. Because it's very hard, I think, to do a scene like that and then be like, oh yeah, I still like you as a character or as a person.
Yeah, I like the name. And that's pushed. That is integrated into the story. That the elevator scene where he kicks the fucking guy's head in, and you see her horrified reaction, and part of like why he kind of says goodbye in that moment is because like, okay, this is masks off now. I'm gonna have to do what I do in order to save us, and you're probably not going to like it.
Yeah.
And you feel that conflict, and you feel all these moments that these extents that he gets put to. And I think you are meant to kind of be a little bit horrified by him. I mean, the scene where he drives Nina off the cliff and fucking drowns him in the water. Like, first of all, like, yeah. that's just a great little scene, sequence of events. It looks so great with the light flashing from the lighthouse,
And, yeah.
Just a beautiful looking moment. But I like how it's kind of like a, you know, it's kind of like a reverse horror movie, and it's for a little bit, you're kind of like, oh man, I feel bad for Nina here. He's going to get fucked.
Poor guy, yeah. And that's kind of a good callback as well to Newton Thomas Segel and how brilliant it is he is at choosing, like, how he works with light in that situation. Like, if I was shooting on a beach, I wouldn't think for a fucking second to use like a lighthouse at night to make it so it's basically pitch black. You can only see everyone with headlights, and every now and again you get like glimpses of just like the horror on like Nino's face, or just like the action of him running towards him or something like that.
Really adds to that tension, doesn't it?
What a brilliant way to use light to build tension. And all of the film is considered in that way, it feels like.
Yeah, the shot composition is really interesting. A lot of the time they shoot him, they shoot a driver far away from people or in like the background while someone's in the foreground. So you get a sense of distance. You mentioned the scene where he kind of with the hammer and the way you have that extremely low angle as you see him, like his fist clenched and he's shaking and he's on the phone. Although it's like just, it just adds to that moment of intensity, and it's simple, like, you know, like film studies 101, like shoot them at a low angle or high angle to, you know, create dominance, a sense of dominance. But like, it's so effective.
It's so drastic whenever that happens. Like whenever there's a convention used that way, it's always accentuated a little bit further, so generally conversations won't be shot too, you know, crazily in terms of composition, because they don't need to be. So when you have scenes like that where it's so low, like you are, like he's holding a hammer to your head and you're looking up at him, it really does kind of build on it so much more. And it goes the same, it's the same for all of the car stuff as well. Like, it's all shot either right outside of the windshield, very close on his face, so you just get a better perspective of his emotion, or you're in the passenger seat.
Yeah, it's very confined to the car.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't get many stylized shots of wheels, or like seeing like police helicopter shots of the car or anything like that. You are in the boot. You are in like the back seat, or you're in the side seat. And you'll have like camera movement looking to the guys in the back and then being really close up to him and watching his move, like every move and every twitch in his face to decide what he's going to do. It is brilliant. It's very well shot, and it's crazy that in such like a we used a word for it earlier, like just kind of on the nose movie, that he finds so much room within the cinematography to tell its own story. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, I love its feet on the ground approach, while it can also be very dreamy and stylized. And I think that's just a really interesting balance. And I think that's something that Refn does really well in his other movies. Yeah, man, Drive's fucking awesome. It was so nice to see it on the big screen as well. Like, it's so nice to watch a favorite on the big screen in a cool projection.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very rare to get an opportunity like that. And
the sound too. I remember one gunshot in particular.
Fucking hell.
Fucking scaring the ghost out of us. And that was like that feeling was something I missed, of like the, you know, because you can turn your laptop all the way up, but it's just not quite the same to have that proper gut wrench, like, oh my god, fucking hell.
it was in that scene, it's so well shot and it's so tense anyway that I don't think a single person in the cinema was breathing. So when that fucking gun, although I knew it was coming,
I think we all know it was coming, but you're still so invested
like,
in it.
You still have, it's so well like edited in the fact that there's no like visual key to when it's going to happen. So I completely forgot at what point the gunshot goes off. So when it did, and it was the only sound in that fucking cinema, every single person jumped out of their seat. And it was brilliant. And it's the same thing that we were talking about for the past, well, for the entire existence of this podcast, is how much we've missed that. And it's really hyped me up for everything else that we're eventually going to go and be able to see together.
Absolutely.
Slowly, yeah. Slowly but surely.
Slowly but surely. All right, do you have any final thoughts on Drive? Anything you want to share with the class?
It's annoying. I seem to just like it every time I go to see it. It's definitely one of those movies that it's very fair to kind of judge for how very unsubtle it is. I think it's very fair to be like, look, it's a very kind of like masculine movie, but it does have its moments that shine through as just in general being a good movie. And it's just so much fun, and it's beautiful to look at, and the soundtrack's great. Like, you know, I don't think there's ever been a time in a driving at night, being in a car at night, where I haven't wanted to put one of those, you know, bits of music on. It's very stylistically tuned in. So if you're looking for a movie that's action-packed, you know, it's got a great edge to it, some fantastic performances throughout, Drive's just a solid choice. And is a good like introduction to Grindhouse as well. I mean, a lot of people would probably argue that this isn't necessarily Grindhouse. Maybe this is a little bit more kind of like,
it's more
neo noir, or just,
no, it's more like B movie aesthetic. And I don't know, that's necessarily Grindhouse. Grindhouse, I feel like it's like another level down on the ladder. But it's very, I mean, it's fun. Like, it's a completely fun movie. And I think once it really starts to hit its stride, it's so watchable. And then I think part of why it's been one that we've always come back to is because, like, you come back to it and you notice something different about it. In maybe not in like a life-changingly deep, interesting way, but you know, you notice another little kind of cheeky little nod and wink to you as the audience, or you notice how a theme works in the narrative. And I don't think I really got to articulate how well I think it works with its themes and ideas, but it does really well.
Yeah.
Because it's not asking a lot. It is simple. Everything is just cohesively about what the film is about. And part of what it is about is just, you know, the driver and being a hero and real human being. And but I like that. I don't know. I love it. I love its direction. I love its style.
Yeah.
And I love, there's some great performances in here too. I don't think anyone, I can see it's working for a lot of people. I like some of the slower, more arty flourishes in there might put some people off.
Sure. Yeah, it can take you out of it a little bit, but not enough to ruin it for me.
Yeah, like, not to make a pun, but some of the switching of gears can feel a bit awkward at times, but
yeah. It's not like a Guy Ritchie film where you might have like a montage that is, you know, full of film burns and, you know, kind of very unrealistic transition or hyper-stylized transitions. It's not like that. It just looks very stylized. And I think its drama, it grounds it as a more serious movie, as opposed to something like perhaps a Guy Ritchie film, which deliberately is more kind of like that. But
yeah, it's not obnoxious, so I wouldn't say it's obnoxious in a way that something like that can tend to lean towards.
Yeah. Right.
Awesome. Well, do you want to what's your rating for Drive?
It's up there. It's like a, you know, 4, 4.5. It's nice. A movie that I've loved for like a very long time, and having watched it again in a cinema, still stand by it. It's very solid.
Yeah, so nine star, definitely. I love it. Love it every time. The thing, even though the things that I think are kind of flawed with it stand out more, all the things that are really great about it stand out more as well. So I think that that's a good thing at the end of the day. Check it out. I don't know if you can all make it down to the Prince Charles, but if you do ever get a chance to see it on the big screen, watch it loud.
Yeah, I think that cinema's definitely now on our certified, it's final draft certified, that cinema.
Final draft certified. You're welcome, Prince Charles Cinema.
Yeah, I'm sure they don't need it, but there you go. It's got the stamp of approval. It's a brilliant place to watch film projection if you're here if you live in the UK. It's worth the trip, quite honestly. It's brilliant. And it's great to support, independent cinema as well, wherever you can.
Absolutely. All right, guys. Well, thank you. Thank you for listening. I've got a favourite.
We're off to the cinema again.
Yeah. Maybe the Odeon. Because I haven't.
Yeah, fucking hell. You've got no pennies left after that week. Yeah.
No. But yeah, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, listen, okay, do me a favor, please go to Apple Podcasts, and if you like the show, leave a 5-star review. Like, you know, I it takes 2 seconds to just leave a 5-star review and write something nice. If you want to, helps us out in the long term. And if you want to keep up to date with the show, you can follow us at Final Draft Pod at Twitter and Final Draft Show on Instagram, or it might be the other way around, who knows. And I think we're on Facebook. You just search for the Final Draft. You can email me at finaldraftpodcast@gmail.com. Also on our social media, there's a link to our Discord. Again, join the Discord. Why not? Just join it. Join it. It's a fun time. We share memes in there. Isn't that cool? Isn't that interesting?
Oh,
please. Please give me validation.
It does go a long way, though, the Apple Podcast thing. It seems that
it does.
It benefits podcasts a lot more on Apple Music when you rate them in that way for some reason. It's just apparently the algorithm. So it does help, guys. It helps a lot.
Yeah, it helps with the numbers. It can also be a bit dodgy sometimes, I will say, so you might want to do it a couple of times just to make sure it worked. I'm not just saying that. Generally, like, it's very buggy for some reason. And also, you know, if you like the episode, just share it. We put the posts up. Share them on your Twitter. Share them on Instagram. Share them on Facebook. Tell a friend. Go, you know, here's your task for this week, all right? I want you to go tell at least 5 friends.
Your homework.
Tell 5 friends to listen to the show, and then report back to me, and then follow up with them and make sure
and
they actually did it.
If you lose those 5 friends, join the Discord, because you'll make 5 more.
And if they didn't listen to it, well, they're not very good friends, clearly. You don't really want to hang out with those people. Then you need to ask 5 more people, because clearly those first 5 weren't taking it. So then you come back to me, you tell me about it, and I'm like, okay, cool. And then you go back and ask them. Also, make sure that their retention's good.
It's a system.
The retention really matters. Like, don't make them just kind of half play it. That doesn't count. They need good retention on the download. So if you make them play the whole thing, sit there and watch them. Sit in a room and watch them.
Make sure.
While you listen to the podcast. And it'll all be good.
Like, extra laugh to the funny moments.
Oh,
so
yeah,
they
you have
laugh
to.
As well at a normal level. Yeah.
Basically, just have them, you know, share the headphones and make eye contact with them throughout the whole thing while you listen to us talk about movies.
That's what we do when we watch movies together, isn't it, Alex? We just stare at each other.
Oh, yeah.
it's the way to do it, guys. It's how you make friends.
Oh, man.
It's how you get close. You know a lot about someone.
What else was that? Oh, yes. And also, if you want to support the show in a more meaningful way, the most meaningful way you can support the show is go to patreon.com/thefinaldraft. £5 a month gets you access to the writer's room. Bonus episodes once a month. I think I'm going to start doing them at the start of each month now. So you'll get them probably the first of each month, but don't hold me to it. There's 2 episodes up there now. We just put one up about nerdy stuff. We talked about Spider-Man.
It was so much fun, to be fair. We had a right giggle.
I talk about Doctor Who, something I vowed you would never do on the show.
The agreement we came to is that it'd have to be behind a paywall so you guys didn't have to suffer. But if you want to suffer, as Alex did. We had a good discussion about nostalgia as well. That
was a good talk.
That was very funny.
It was a long one. It was a long one. So if you're craving more Final Draft content,
2 hours.
Yeah, if you want a 2 hour podcast, go to patreon.com. Thanks, guys. Double feature will be back next week. We should be back on Monday, I think.
Yeah.
Depending on what happens. What's the films again? You Were Never Really Here and Leon the Professional. And then
there you go.
I don't know what our next one-off's going to be.
I've already chosen my next week's double feature. I watched it last night for the first time.
Well,
bloody enjoyed it.
Cool. Well, we can talk up.
You're going to have to keep listening, folks, don't you, to find out. It's going to be burning away at you now. You're going to have no choice.
All right. It's a poo, so let's go. Let's go. Let's get out of it. Come on, kid.
Well, if that's not a cue, I don't know what is.
Thanks
guys.
Bye.